It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
All righty, welcome to the show. It's hour number two, if you're just tuning in. And it's Labor Day weekend. So, I'm just delighted that you're spending a little bit of time with us. Maybe you're listening to this on our YouTube channel. Maybe you want to go find old shows. Just go to YouTube and search Jill Schlesinger, because Mark has not figured out how to just search Jill on Money. If you search Jill on Money, will the page come up or not? He says probably, and I don't find that convincing. I don't know about you. Okay, I want to get you ready for our guest, Bill Cohan, William D. Cohan. I love this guy. I actually interviewed him a long time ago when I was working at CBS Money Watch. And this guy is was a senior Wall Street mergers and acquisitions banker, 17 years. He worked at Lazard Frere, Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan Chase, but he's a great writer. He wrote the big book about Goldman Sachs, how Goldman Sachs came to rule the world. He also wrote House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He wrote a really wild book also about Duke that I should also recommend, which has nothing to do with it because he is a graduate of Duke University. His most recent book, which is why I have him coming on the program, is called Why Wall Street Matters. And here you have a guy who is a former critic to come and really explain why the business of Wall Street is so important. So here's my interview with Bill Cohan. What's the very best money decision that you've made in your personal life?
Aside from, say, getting married, because there's obvious benefits.
Why? Because was she rich or
no? But I think there are. I'm constantly told there are like tax benefits for being married. I think that I've made a few. I mean, one of the nice things about having been a banker is that you do understand money and the way it works and investments. I don't give investment advice, but I would say my best investments have been my real estate. Because I was able to buy, obviously real estate market's very cyclical, but I was able to buy all three of my homes at a very smart time, and they've all appreciated.
Let's get into this book. Yeah. Why'd you write this book, Why Wall Street Matters? You've been somewhat of a critic of the excesses of Wall Street. So in this book, you're kind of a cheerleader for the business.
Right. And I think that part of that is because, the pendulum swings, right? I'm a reporter. I'm an investigative reporter. And so I pride myself on calling it like I see it. And when I wrote the book about Lazard, I mean, Lazard was sort of all about over-the-top personalities and excess. And the collapse of Bear Stearns, that, of course, was an unbelievable story of mismanagement and absurd risk-taking. Goldman is, of course, all about, excess and flamboyance in so many different ways. So, I mean, and a big part of the Goldman book also was about how Goldman managed to both at once exacerbate the crisis and avoid it for its own account. As a result of those three books, I just uncovered so much wrongdoing that led to, in many respects, the financial crisis. And So that was my view, but I think what happened was the catalyst. Let's go there. The catalyst for the sort of Nixon opening China moment is when Elizabeth Warren prevented Antonio Weiss from becoming, I think, an undersecretary of the Treasury, only because he had worked on Wall Street. He had worked, he was head of investment banking at Lazard. It turned out that I trained Antonio when I was a banker at Lazard, and Antonio is a great guy, and he has a very progressive thinker. His politics were actually quite close to Elizabeth Warren's, and yet she would not even take a meeting with him even after President Obama nominated him, and I thought that was unacceptable. And so that said to me that the pendulum had swung too far, and I just had to write this.
And in your introduction, you say, I agree with much of the progressive agendas advocated by Senators Sanders and Warren, and I voted Democratic my entire adult life, but they haven't a clue when it comes to understanding Wall Street. So what do they need to understand, and what do other people need to understand as they're listening to this and have maybe that vampire squid notion of Wall Street and the distrust?
Sure. Well, I mean, that was obviously a line for the ages, right? But unfortunately, it has nothing to do. I mean, what does it even mean anyway? But it's one of those great images that summed up the zeitgeist at that particular moment. I mean, the short answer is what people need to understand is, is contained in this relatively short book, especially a short book by William Cohen's standards. But the important thing, what's sort of shocking about, I mean, I can almost forgive Senator Sanders. He's a avuncular, former mayor of Burlington, Vermont. What does he know about, he grew up in Brooklyn. What does he know from Wall Street? But Elizabeth Warren is a bankruptcy or was a bankruptcy professor at Harvard Law School. Now, when I was at Lazard, I did a lot of restructuring work. And one thing restructuring work teaches you fundamentally is how capital structures work, how subordination works, how claims work and liens work, and how you take apart these capital structures that Wall Street puts together. And I don't see how you could teach that subject at Harvard Law School without understanding how Wall Street works. So to me, either she is being willfully deceitful about her understanding, or it's even worse, she doesn't understand, and she should never have been teaching at Harvard Law School in the first place. But the thing to really that I think is fundamental, and I go through the history of Wall Street, and there was actually a wall that was built, which was why it was called Wall Street. And but basically, what Wall Street has done really well for more than 200 years is provide capital to people who want it and are willing to pay a fair price for it, businesses, entrepreneurs, taking that money from people who have it. It's really a clearinghouse. It's sort of an interstitial kind of function. And it does that in a really, really efficient, smart way.
All right, more of our interview with Bill Cohan when we return. It's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Jill. That's the number to call to have your financial questions answered. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. If you've got a question, anything going on, just give us a holler. 855-411-JILL. Send us an email. askjill@jillonmoney.com. You can also go to the website if you want, jillonmoney.com, lots of stuff up there. Just a quick aside that I know there's a lot of people who are kind of starting back on track with their financial planning and big questions. I keep getting emails from folks who are asking me about the best 529 plans if you don't like the one in your state. So once again, for those folks, Nevada, Utah, Alaska, Maryland. Those are kind of like the biggies. If your own 529 plan in your state doesn't give you a tax advantage or you don't like the plan. Okay, little personal finance before we go into Wall Street. Our guest, Bill Cohan, has been part of Wall Street for a long time, but also has been writing about it. His most recent book is called Why Wall Street Matters. And what is so important about Wall Street is that you may not realize it, but it is the ability to finance companies. It helps create businesses. Check this out.
There would be no CBS Corporation. There would be no Apple, as I talk about in the book. There'd be no pickup trucks or guns or gun racks or not. I mean, there'd be none of that. None of that. There'd be no farming. There'd be none of the things that we take utterly and completely for granted if it hadn't been for how good Wall Street is. And by the way, it's a world leader. Other governments look to it. Other corporations around the world look to it to finance them and for advice. This is a national jewel. And the beautiful machine that Wall Street created to finance companies for the past 200 or 300 years is remarkable. And my view was that, you know, because of not only Elizabeth Warren, but Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who were crapping out all over Wall Street for the last 8 years. And I understand why that all happened, because it was, you know, political opportunism, and it was, you know, very popular. And it and by the way, Wall Street did mess up and wasn't held accountable for it. But what's happening, unfortunately, with all this huge re-regulation of Dodd-Frank and the 20,000 pages of additional rules and regulation is that you're throwing sand into the beautiful machine. And when you throw sand into the beautiful machine, you're kind of, as Larry Summers has written so articulately and talked about so articulately, you've got what is called the secular stagnation, or what he's called secular stagnation, and condemning the American economy to like 2% growth. And you saw in the end of last year, we grew at like 1.9%. No wonder people are frustrated by that, because that's not high enough growth.
Let's go back to what I think you believe may be the original sin that started the beginning of the excesses. Now, you know, full disclosure, my dad was a trader on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. So all these like fancy investment bankers, that was like a world away for me. But he would say to me, you know, we're trading here, we're making some money. He would say to me, it's not like you are enhancing capitalism by being a trader necessarily. That's what investment bankers do. And so you talked about that. What happened as these big institutions went from being private partnerships where the partners had their own money at risk to publicly traded companies? What happened then?
Well, that's the crucial moment. That's like the Big Bang. People talk about the Big Bang on Wall Street and they say it's, you know, related to brokerage firms or whatever. The Big Bang on Wall Street was 1970, really 1969, when this highly respected firm, Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrett, small firm, incredibly profitable, decided to buck the New York Stock Exchange rules, which were quite clear and formidable, and no one had ever tried to do it before, and wanted to go public. And in fact, Dan Lufkin, who was one of the founders of DLJ, went to his first New York Stock Exchange Board of Governors meeting with his S-1, this registration statement for an IPO, under his arm. He had just filed it, and he brought it to the Board of Governors meeting, and, you know, the great, you know, New York Stock Exchange Board of Governors were aghast that Dan Lufkin had flouted the rules so explicitly and willingly. But they were determined for right reasons, by the way. I mean, it's sort of ironic that Wall Street is in the business of raising capital for others, but was not allowed to raise capital for itself. So these firms had been, you know, undercapitalized. In 1970, DLJ was no longer private. It went public. They got the New York Stock Exchange to change the rules. And then one firm after another went public. You know, when Merrill Lynch announced it was going public 2 years later, which was the biggest securities firm on Wall Street, that was front page news in the New York Times, the upper right story, the biggest story of the day. Basically, that changed the whole ethos on Wall Street from one where, you know, individual partners had their own net worths on the line every day, and it could be lost in an instant by something foolish that one of their partners would do, to a culture where everybody was playing with other people's money.
But meanwhile, the barn door was open. Everyone goes public, even everyone. Goldman. And I mean,
they went May 1999.
Right. So that's the top right there.
There you go.
Now that all these companies are public, They're very excited about using the public money and increasing their risk levels to, and yes, I know the dot-com boom and bust hurt them, but coming out of that, there were all these great ways to make money. And I think that you're suggesting that there's no way those companies, if they were private partnerships, would have levered up 30-1. There would be no financial crisis if they were personally on the line for those bets.
So it gets a little complicated because obviously before 1970, the firms were occasionally quite levered because they didn't have much capital. They were levered in the sense that they were undercapitalized.
Right.
But they were taking prudent risks with their own money. So that's a mentality, right?
Right.
And then all these firms start going public. They have much more capital. They get rewarded to take big risks with other people's money. This whole ethos of prudent risks with their own money is lost. And that was married, as I talk about in the book, at a time of actually incredible innovation on Wall Street. So the securitization market, the derivatives market, the high yield market, all those things got created.
Which are not bad things.
They're all good things.
Okay, so everyone, like, take a deep breath when you hear
they're
that.
They're all really important things.
By the way, just parenthetically, I'll never forget when my mother called me and said, "Aren't you a derivatives trader?" Like, it was such an accusation. I'm like, "Well, yes, that's how I got my training. Remember, I traded options." She's like, "Well, that's not good right now."
Well, I mean, another one of the reasons I wrote this book is because Wall Street has constructed this black box around itself, and you know they have their own language. And once people start hearing it, their eyes glaze over. It's like, you know, talking about the Affordable Care Act or something. People don't know how to understand it. And so I wanted to make this Wall Street understandable to the people who basically said, who are too afraid to admit that they don't understand what Wall Street's all about to ask someone. It's like, okay, I'm 45 years old now.
I should know.
I've gone through my whole life thinking I should know, and now I don't want to ask anybody. But if I can just pick up this book and understand it, then we can actually have a discussion about it because it's laid out fairly simply and clearly. And it's just a shame that something this important has been shrouded in so much mystery and is so easily manipulated by politicians and regulators who want to demagogue the issue.
Okay, we have this terrible crisis, and we get this over-the-top Dodd-Frank reform, whatever it was, 2,300 pages or something horrible like that. When you look at what happened in the crisis and the aftermath, the response to it, what do you think should have happened?
So the first thing that should have happened after the crisis is that there should have been real prosecution of wrongdoing. Full stop.
And where would that have started?
Oh, my God.
In your mind?
There was so much evidence of wrongdoing. I mean, I've had this discussion with Preet Bharara. You know, he's made his bones as prosecuting insider trading, which is low-hanging fruit. He should have spent much more time and effort and energy going after Wall Street, because it's important for people to see that when wrongdoing occurs, people get punished for it.
Okay, it's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back with more of my interview with Bill Cohan.
Jill. That's the number to call to have your financial questions answered. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money, and this is the program that helps you understand why Wall Street matters. Our guest, Bill Cohan, just wrote a book of that title. He's also been a pretty powerful critic of the industry. And in this segment, he's going to talk about why more people on Wall Street were not prosecuted after the financial crisis. When I talk to Wall Street attorneys, they'll say to me, the reason they didn't bring a case is because there was no criminal wrongdoing, and these civil cases are too thorny, and they didn't want to lose, and da-da-da-da-da. That's the line.
Okay, well, so the da 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 didn't want to lose line. That's an interesting argument, and that came from the fact that when they prosecuted the two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers in the Eastern District of New York, the federal prosecutors lost the case. It went to a jury, and the jury acquitted the men. Now, in my book, House of Cards, I cite several documents which show clear intent of these two guys to basically deceive their investors.
Okay.
And that book came out before the trial. All they had to do, these smart alecky federal prosecutors, was read my book. And that section of the book where I cite these documents, they could have just subpoenaed those documents. I got them, they could get them, and they could have used them. But they didn't do that, and they didn't use them, and these guys walked away.
So that was an early loss that kind of freaked out the other folks.
Freaked out the Justice Department, and said that was, you know, October 2009 or whatever it was. You know, if we can't win that one, then, you know, there must be nothing here. And by the way, that was just one instance. I mean, I've written countless stories about whistleblowers at Citigroup, at J.P. Morgan Chase, at Barclays, where compliance officers, managers clearly saw wrongdoing, especially around knowingly packaging up these mortgages that they knew did not meet their credit standards. They knew that the people who took out these mortgages would never pay them back, and they packaged them up, slapped the AAA rating on them, and sold them as investments all around the world. And they knowingly did that, and I've written plenty of stories about those people. Those people end up getting fired, and their dossiers sort of get referred to the SEC or the Justice Department, and nothing ever happened.
Okay, but we can't go back and relitigate that.
So that should have happened.
So that should have happened. We didn't get that. And by the way, Eric Holder, I don't get him. Like, what was this? Like a huge squeeze? Because to me, instead of prosecuting, what he did is he had these very strange settlements that were, it felt like mobster-esque. Like, you know, you're just going to pay us.
I've described that as extortion.
Yes, I think that would be the right term.
And it's extorting the shareholders who have nothing to do with what happened.
Right. I mean, you're basically saying shareholders are going to have to pay these hundreds of million dollar fines because, you know,
billions.
You guys are billions and you're in the penalty box because I didn't prosecute you the right way.
Right.
So now I'm just going to grab your money.
That's not the same as justice. Holding up these big banks for these huge settlements, $13 billion, J.P. Morgan, $17 billion, B of A, that's not the same as justice. So they were cowards. Instead of actually trying to prosecute the wrongdoing, they said, oh, by the way, we can put you out of business. We can indict you or whatever. Instead of that, you pay us all this money.
Okay, so we didn't prosecute.
We didn't do that.
So
there's a vacuum.
Right.
People are angry. And into that vacuum came politicians who decided, hey, this is a good issue to demagogue. They demagogued. We passed Dodd-Frank. It's a ridiculous law, you know, 2,300 pages, 20,000 pages of rules and regulations, throwing sand into the beautiful machine, as I said. Mm.
So what has to happen now in your mind? I don't want to let you go without getting your prescription going forward.
To me, it's all about the compensation system. It's all about what people on Wall Street are rewarded to do.
But
one's talking about that.
Can the government actually weigh in on that?
The government can weigh in on anything it wants. If I were Donald Trump, and I've written this lately, I would make a grand bargain with Wall Street. And I would say, you know, he's like the deal maker in chief, right?
Yeah.
Or thinks he is.
Yes.
I would make a grand bargain with Wall Street. I would say, you want these Dodd-Frank laws reformed. You want these regulations reformed. You want some relief from the Fed regulations. I'm willing to do that only if you reform your compensation system to make people, some people, not all, the big wigs, those people need to have their full net worth on the line again. There needs to be accountability so that their mind never wanders from the idea of prudent risk taking.
So what's interesting is I felt like that opportunity was lost on Obama because there was so much crap hitting the fan in 2009 and 2010 that when he probably could have made that deal without actually getting anything. He wouldn't have to give up anything for that.
That's
essentially
true.
That he had his foot on the throat, and then he let Geithner convince him that like the whole world was going to fall apart if he did something like that.
Well, that's because Geithner was basically in the pocket of Wall Street, and Wall Street would not like this. But there was a lot of things going on, and his first mission was to, you know, save the economy, to stop
the bleeding.
You know, absolutely put a tourniquet. This is actually an even better moment because the economy is strong, right? We don't need to stop any bleeding. Wall Street obviously wants this monkey off their back. And so Donald Trump has an incredible amount of leverage over Wall Street to get this done.
You think that Mnuchin and Wilbur Ross and Gary Cohn are going to advocate for that?
Well, they know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I know them all.
Yeah.
They know exactly what I'm talking about. They know I'm right. They know that this is the, you know, the devil that's once again in the details of Wall Street. But will they do it? I don't know. If there were real leadership on Wall Street, if Lloyd Blankfein were acting like a real leader or Jamie Dimon were acting like a real leader, they would voluntarily do this. They would say, no one's asking us to do this. We want to do it because it's the right thing. When was the last time on Wall Street somebody stood up and said, I want to do the right thing?
I think that would have been my first boss, Peter Kellogg from Spear Leeds and Kellogg. He may have been one of the last of that breed. Bill Cohen, he is the author of Why Wall Street Matters. It is a beautiful, slim little black book. You can put it, tuck it right into your knapsack or sequin evening bag. Before we let you go, I started the interview with what was your best money decision? What was your worst?
Mm. I invested in a few, especially during the dot-com bubble era, a few things that sounded great that were not.
And so that was it. A few good, a few bad, and net-net you're doing pretty well.
Mostly good, believe it or not.
Isn't that great?
And then a valuable thing I learned, and I don't like to give investment advice, but instead of freaking out when the Dow goes to 6,500 in March of 2009, you just stay invested, and now look. Now we're 21,000 and counting, so that's easily triple your money.
All right, Bill Cohen, thank you so much for joining us. Go get his book, Why Wall Street Matters. And while you're there, go check out his other books. One of my favorites is called House of Cards, which is about the whole housing crisis. You're listening to Jill on Money. And when we return, we get back to your questions. 855-411-JILL is our phone number. Send us an email. AskJill@JillOnMoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's the weekend, and that can only mean one thing. You're listening to Jill on Money. Here she is, Jill Schlesinger. What you want,
baby, I got what you need. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Our email address is askjill@jillonmoney.com. Okay. I'm not outing anybody by giving you this name of someone who wrote us an email, but I'm sure it's not quite translating the right way, because this guy's name is Iago, and I can't imagine, that's how I knew that he was probably foreign, because, you know, he's the bad dude in Othello. I just want to point that out. He asked a great question, which required a little bit of research on my part. He said, Dear Jill, I am subscribed to your podcast, and thanks to the show, I found out about Betterment and index funds and passive investing in general. I'm 32 and I live in Denmark, and I would love to invest in a robo-advisor, but I'm not sure what's available in Europe or worldwide. A lot of the U.S. ones, like your sponsor Betterment, not available to me. So, I don't have a ton right now, because I went and just sort of looked around and tried to do the best I could. There's something called Swanist, which is available in Europe. I don't have a ton of information about these, so I'm just going to give you based on like what I kind of came up with. There are some that, you know, some of these are just country specific, which is so weird to me. There's a couple in Germany, Scalable Capital, but they're not that, I don't know, they're not that great in terms of like when they rank them. So, I don't know. I think you're going to have to wait to see if you can. Maybe what you would do is just use index funds until you get a little bit more, more competition there. There's another one here called ETF-matic. We just use index funds. I can't give you a thumbs up on any of these. I'm just giving you names, which you could probably find. So, I'm going to say, use some index funds. Don't use a robo yet till you get a little more competition in your country, and keep it simple. Index funds will be fine for you, and I wouldn't worry too much about it. But thank you for writing. All right, check this out. Mike writes, let me just make sure I'm allowed to use his name. Yes, phew, Mike writes. Someone recently recommended your podcast to me, and I've been banging out episodes trying to catch up. Great stuff. Hey, by the way, you're listening to a radio show, but my podcast is called Better Off, and you can get it on Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. So go check it out. How are our numbers doing on the podcast, Mark? Are we doing all right? Increasing? Slowly but surely? Well, you know what? If everyone listening to this radio show also subscribed to the podcast, our numbers would look better. Help us out. Come on, man. Okay, so Mike says, I've got a different kind of question than the ones I've heard so far. I was laid off from my IT job in April of 2016. I took the summer off, and when I started looking for a job, my heart wasn't in it. After 20 years in IT, I've just had enough. I'm 51. It's time for a change. I have built up my savings, and I have no debt. Now's the time to do this. I've always been interested in finances. But I don't have any degree, so I'm a 51-year-old full-time college student at a community college for an associate's degree. Then I'm off to a real college, and my end game is to be a CFP. I know that's a bit down the line. My concern right now is, what am I going to do once I have my bachelor's degree, since I'll be in my mid-50s with zero experience? Do you have suggestions as to how to break into the field or what kind of jobs I should look for? Banks, private firms? I've switched careers before. I know I'll start at the bottom. That's okay. One of my reasons for choosing this field is to help people with their finances. I think that too many people think finances, stock funds are complicated. It just isn't. They just need a little push and direction. Due to my age, I really don't see myself opening up my own business. Thank you for any advice you could provide. Mike, wonderful question. First of all, good for you. That's number one. But number two, I think there's a couple of things that I would suggest. And, you know, one resource that I think is great is the CFP website. So if you go to, you know, there's a site that's really directed towards financial advisors and CFPs themselves, and that's CFP.net. And on that website, what's interesting is there is a career center. And it will help you look at kind of different resources, and there are jobs there. There's a section for job seekers. There's a section for employers. And this is really cool, because I think what happens is you'll see that, like, the kinds of jobs that are available, a paraplanner, a financial planning assistant, that's a really good job. There's also the kinds, you could go to a big firm and work for an advisor who has an established book of business and break in. And what the way I would look at it is this, is that if you can do this and you can break into a larger firm, you say, hey, I'm the kind of person, like, I know how to talk to real people. Not that there's anything wrong with a 22-year-old who's breaking in, but it's a really nice thing from a client perspective to have a mature human being on the line who knows how to handle him or herself in a way that a younger person just can't. So I would check that out. careers.cfp.net. Check that out. Thanks so much for that note, and good luck. Keep us posted. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Okay, got a note from Anonymous. I'm a big fan of your show. I have a question for you. We have a decent amount of equity in our home. Our house is worth $650,000. We owe $328,000. We have a 3.25% fixed rate mortgage, 16 years to pay off. However, we've accumulated $32,000 of credit card debt, generally in the 12 to 14% range. We live within our means. The credit card came from an untimely job layoff. The sticking point, so he wanted to basically say he wants a home equity line of credit to consolidate his credit card debt. The sticking point is that we used a state mortgage assistance program in 2014 to help pay our mortgage for about 8 months while I was between jobs. The program was a lifeline. It got us through a tough period. It was structured as a zero-interest forgivable loan, meaning we could only get the HELOC if I apply some of those proceeds to pay off the secondary mortgage in full. The amount owed is $17,500. Secondary loan drops 20% a year, disappear altogether. If we just stay in the house, it's a great return, but it's costing us an otherwise by preventing the HELOC, which would let us pay down our credit card debt faster or with less interest. I have the feeling we should tough it out and continue on our current course, but do you see a scenario would be worth to pay off the other free money? I don't know. I think you're going to have to tough it out, man. It seems incredibly confusing the scenario you just laid out about, you know, do you get some money that you can free up that you can pay down the loan at lower rates? Yeah, if you can do it, great. But I just wonder if a bank's really going to do it. So it's only 2020. Let's think. Where are we? 17? I'm more leaning towards stick to it. Stick with what you got. All right. And if you can get some money that's kind of, you can plop down on that, maybe you do that. Or maybe you borrow from your 401k, but give it a shot. All right. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks to Bill Cohan again for appearing on the show. Go get his book. And if you have any questions, give us a holler. Ask Jill at JillOnMoney.com. We will see you next week. Happy Labor Day weekend.